Hey everybody, J.J. Cooper, Carlos Colosso, another Baseball America Draft podcast, and you can see the bags under both of our eyes, probably a little bit more under mine than Carlos's, but that's not because Carlos has probably actually been working harder than I have, because we are wrapping up the draft preview issue of the print magazine, which is kind of one of the demarcation points, I would say, in the draft process, because what that means is we've done an update to, again, you saw it up there. We went to 500 on the site, 500 rank, you know, ranking the top 500 draft prospects for this year. But then, having lined that up, Carlos kind of starts the process of going back and updating the reports for everyone at the top, right? Because unfortunately, there are just so many hours in the day. So we put reports in, but we don't have time to go update everyone's report for all 500 players every month. So the reports for players at the top, which we are now going to be bringing to the website as well, are the ones that kind of end up being a little bit the most stale in some ways, except for unusual circumstances, a major injury or a player who moved into the 100 or whatever.
Right.
But the Rock Chulowskis and the Grady Emersons of the world, those reports are kind of like, okay, we wrote that very early in the spring process. Mm-hmm. Now we're circling back to them. And that's what we're going to talk about today, because in the process of doing that, you kind of, the thing that I think both Carlos and I both love is when you write these reports, you may come into it with ideas, but the process of going through your notes, of going through what we have, of looking again at the player, at looking at the data, look, putting all of it together, and then writing the player up.
Yep.
Even the mere act of writing that player, often, Carlos, I feel like it can change your perception of where that player, what you think about that player. Is that a, is that work for you the same way it does for me?
Yeah, 100%. I think for me, writing is the best way to think. And that's definitely true of thinking through a player and a player's profile, and kind of the way you were expressing it, I think is super true. Like, we have pictures of these players in our head. We're obviously very familiar with these players, but I think there is something to just the process of going through and updating our reports on all these players, putting all the final full, and for a lot of these guys, we do still have super regionals coming up this weekend. So it's not like end of season for every single player, but for most players, the season is over. We have final kind of performance numbers to look at. High school seasons around the country are done. So we've just got like a culmination of performance information to kind of look at, sort through. It's a fun process for me, just sorting through all the notes, seeing, like, in many ways, the top players, and maybe Rock Chulowski is the greatest example of this. Like, his profile has not changed too much. We still need to, like, show what he did during his draft year. That's very important to put out. But, like, how I thought of Rock Chulowski before the season versus how I think of him now hasn't changed significantly. And I think that is partially just a testament to him going out there and taking care of business. But there are players who have been movers on our board throughout the year that you're trying to capture where they rank on talent. You're trying to get feedback from the industry to place them precisely. But I think this is a really great exercise to really fine tune the list and really get precise with how we want to line players up. And I do find myself, like, writing these reports, I try to write in a position group. So I like to write pitchers one after another, and then I like to write hitters one after another. And I do feel like sometimes players just stand out. I'm like, hey, like, I really like this player a lot more than I thought I was going to. Or, hey, I kind of want to move this player up because he has all these pros that we can get into. And, like, the guys in front of him maybe feel a little bit more risky. So I do think there is this sort of crystallization process at this stage. And I really enjoy it. It's been a lot of work to get the Draft Preview magazine together. We're very, very close now. As you're listening to this podcast, maybe my responsibilities will be done. But we unveiled the cover earlier this week. Rock Chulowski and a couple of the top players in the class are on it. I would definitely encourage you guys to go pre-order that. It's cool to have, like, a physical copy while you're watching the draft. And I know we're running, I think we're still running a deal where if you order that now through us, you'll also get kind of a mystery box issue along with that. So we really appreciate the support. But yeah, that's kind of how I'm thinking about it.
So, okay. So what we're going to do today is exactly what Carlos just talked about, which is there are players who, as he kind of was writing these up, you write them up, you look at it, you kind of relook at it again, and you're like, you know, maybe I like this guy a little bit more than where he's slotted right now. And maybe I need to take another look at him, or, you know, so that's what we're going to do today. And we'll start at the top. This is the highest ranked guy that you kind of singled out for this. So I'll just kind of kick it to you, because again, this is going to be me kind of kicking it to you and maybe adding a thought or two, but
yeah,
you're the one who kind of has come to these conclusions as you wrote them up. So what is it about Trevor Condon, the Georgia high school outfielder, that really jumped out as you wrote him up that makes you think, oh, maybe I like this guy even a little bit more? I already liked him. I mean, this is a guy who's been a prominent dude for, it's not like, oh, where did Trevor Condon come from?
And Trevor Condon is the exact sort of player who I think is very endearing to anyone who watches him just because of how he plays the game. He is a very energetic, high effort play style that it's hard to come away not liking Trevor Condon. But I think as I was digging into his profile and some of the feedback we're getting from scouts this season, I think I had maybe underestimated in my mind just the impact that he's able to generate from the left side. Like, he is a smaller player. He is a hit first sort of offensive profile, but his ability to engage his lower half and drive the ball with some sneaky pop kind of changed how I was viewing his profile a little bit personally in my mind. For the, I'd say the majority of this draft cycle, I thought of him as this like contact oriented speedster, old school leadoff traits, who's going to get out of the box really quickly, turn in 70, maybe 80 grade run times, play center field, and you're not going to get much extra base damage from him. I do think like writing this report and just taking a look at what he did this spring, seeing some of the changes to the swing, some of the strength that he's shown, it just made me feel like it was less of a one-dimensional offensive profile. And even if he is not going to hit for 20 plus home runs, I do feel like scouts seem to have enough confidence that he's going to drive the ball with a little bit of authority, enough to get over the fence power, maybe in the mid-teens range, hit a lot of doubles. And when you layer on that to his already impressive profile, I just feel like it's a very complete high school hitting prospect that you have a lot of confidence in. Just the approach, the hitting polish, and the defensive profile. He's very well-rounded, and I didn't expect the grades that we're putting on him right now to be maybe quite as gaudy as they really are across the board.
It does seem like when you look at the high school outfield class, there's like he's, depending on what how you view Jared Grindlinger, he's either the number two or the number three guy in this class, right?
Right.
Like on the high school, like there's Eric Booth Jr. who's at a different level, I would say.
Right.
But does the muddiness of the college outfield class, which is a different demographic, but in the same, in a similar range, you know, right? You know, like it's not like there's a very different, like you're looking at a catcher versus you're looking at an outfielder.
Right.
Does the muddiness of that maybe help a guy like Condon, do you think?
I think that's a great point, and this is one I've heard from the industry when we're trying to figure out this first round. Is I think players like Trevor Condon, and maybe Trevor Condon specifically, because I do think he and Grindlinger are kind of the next up high school hitters, however you want to classify them positionally. I think there's going to be a lot of comfort in both of these profiles. You can even expand it beyond the college outfielders. I think if you're just stacking up Condon next to any of the college hitters available, like in my mind, almost every one of the players you would consider in a similar range have more obvious flaws to their game than Trevor Condon does. And so I think that's going to maybe help him get into a top 15 overall selection on draft day. I know we've heard his name associated with teams in that range. I think maybe the size and the power will kind of limit how high he can climb. But really, once we get outside of the top 10, I think anywhere on the board could be a fit for Condon for exactly those reasons. Yeah.
Other thing that stands out with that is just kind of tying it all together as well, is there just aren't a whole lot of high school bats in his range either. Like it's not a high school class that is deep in first round guys you believe in as far as hitters.
I do think
some
that
at the top.
Yeah.
And then I do think group, that there's a few in between.
Yeah. I think there is a group of guys like Tyler Spangler, Aiden Ruiz, just scrolling down a little bit further, Cole Prosek, Archer Horn, James Clark. Like these are guys who do have a little bit of distance between them in terms of our ranking. But I think I just want to emphasize like that is probably indicating a greater gap in talent than actually exists in this year's class. I do think guys like Cole Prosek, Archer Horn, Certainly Aiden Ruiz, Bo Lawrence, who I passed over and didn't mention. Like, if you wanted to say Bo Lawrence was a pretty similar overall talent to Trevor Condon, I think you could make the case, and I think he could wind up going in a pretty similar spot. So a chance for a lot of these physical hitters, actually.
That range kind of is a whole lot of guys who could go. Like,
the range seems wider. Yes, I think Trevor Condon does have a higher floor than a lot of these guys, but I do think all of those players, just given the muddy nature of the draft, have a chance to go high, potentially on underslot deals or something like that. But yeah.
But we also just mentioned the muddiness of the college outfield class. And you mentioned Zion Rose, the Louisville outfielder, as another guy who really kind of stood out as you put him up. In his case, obviously, there is a starting point, which is he had a late start because of injury. So how much of this is, hey, he came back out, we got to see what he could do, and how much of it is, as you wrote him up, it's like, oh, this guy's a little bit better than maybe what we thought he was coming into the year?
What stands out to me about Zion Rose is just like the confidence in the hit tool and excitement about the future positional profile and power upside. I mean, Zion Rose, I think right now is very much a hit first sort of offensive player. He hit 6 home runs in 36 games. But his performance when he came back, he dealt with an ankle injury that limited him early in the season. When he came back, he was exceptional. He hit 417, 491, 646. And he's really hit at a high level in all three of his seasons at Louisville. He's hit well over 300 every single season. And he's a plus runner. He'll turn in some 70 grade run times, and coming off that ankle injury, I think it's pretty impressive to see that speed just immediately be back. He's a lot stronger than maybe you would think if you were just looking at the home run production that he's shown. And I think depending on like how much you would want to get in the weeds and tweak Zion Rose's swing, because I think his handset, his path, it's downhill frequently. It's a lot of ground balls and line drives, but he does hit the ball a lot harder than I think his home run production maybe indicates. So if he's a guy who just learns how to elevate the ball more consistently at the next level, I think there's an exciting maybe power upside for him. Additionally, I think the defensive profile for Zion is going to be a question. We're getting kind of split camp feedback on how scouts are viewing him as a defender. But because of that speed tool that he has, and because he's playing in an outfield that has Lucas Moore in center field, who's viewed as one of the better defenders in the class, I think there are a lot of teams who are very excited about the potential of him playing center field when there's not a maybe 70 defender pushing him off the position.
At least starting him there and saying, hey, you know, right, we always know he can go back to a corner, but let's see if he can do this. And some of those guys end up being good big league center fielders.
We've seen Jacob Young, who played left field in deference to Judd Fabian, I believe, at Florida. Like, he did not get much time in center field. I know there were scouts who were like, hey, we think he's a really good left fielder. We think like on another team he'd play center field. And Jacob Young, now one of the better defensive center fielders in all of baseball. I'm not saying that Zion Rose is going to be that, but even if you can just not profile as a corner, that mitigates some of the power questions he's going to have now, and also elevates the upside that Zion Rose could have if he does wind up tapping into more power. And so I think, again, we talk about a lot of the question marks that this college outfield class has when writing up Zion Rose, looking at the performance, looking at his contact rate history. It's like 84% overall with Louisville. That's a standout number. He's been an impact base runner. I just feel like he can do a lot of things on the field to add value. And the more I dug into the profile, the more excited I was about it. And he's another one I think could fit in this sort of range we were talking about with Trevor Condon because of all these, like 10 to 20 sounds perfectly reasonable. I think we had him mocked in that range in our most recent mock draft as well.
Another example I want to bring up of what you're talking about for college players who end up being good big league center fielders, Harrison Bader did not play center field, but 2 games in his draft year at Florida. And you know, if you watched him now, you'd be like, wait, what? No, yeah, he didn't. It's not always a slam dunk that because a player doesn't play it in college that he can't handle it in pro ball and in the big leagues.
Yeah, it seems to happen a lot with outfielders as well. I don't know why that is.
So you mentioned like, this kind of goes back to a point that we keep trying to make, and I just want to prepare everyone for draft day, right? Which is, as you just said, someone could say, well, we have Zion Rose right now 29th on your board, and you're saying he could go anywhere from 10th to 20th potentially or later.
Yeah.
And this is a class. There's time for more clarity to develop. But this is very much a class, it feels like, where you get to about pick 8, pick 9, pick 10. And mm-hmm. it is going to be eye of the beholder.
Yep.
And it's going to be what you're going to willing to sign for. A lot of variables, they'll all fit together, but it just seems like over and over, there are a ton of players who it's like, there may be someone on the phone is like, will you take X amount of money mm-hmm. to go here? Yep. And then they're asking their agent, if I say no, what's going to happen? It's like, well, you could go in the next 5 spots or you could go 20 spots from now.
Yeah.
Because that's the range of like, where it's like, this team really likes you, but the next landing spot may be a good bit later on because different teams are going to line up these players very differently mm-hmm. because there's not as much stratification, it feels like.
Yep. Right. Absolutely. I think that's exactly going to be the case. It's going to be fairly chaotic. And I will say, like, an off the board pick, it won't immediately indicate, hey, this is an underslot deal. An off the board pick for one team or for a public ranking like us could just be, hey, this is the best player available for this given team. The talent grouping is that tight and the preferences are going to differ that dramatically, I think, where that will be the case a number of different times on draft day.
Especially because also, again, if you really do feel like, hey, I don't care what the public board says, you know, the consensus boards and all this, mm-hmm. our board has this guy here.
Right.
And we're not going to pick again for another 30, 40 exactly. spots. Yep. If this is our one shot to take him, this is not the year where you're like, well, but we got 5 guys above him on the board necessarily.
Yep.
So we've looked at a couple of outfielders, but there's also some pitchers who really do stand out for this. And we're going to get to those right after this quick break. And we're back. So, Carlos, I'll just say, I feel like there's a number of pitchers that you could have highlighted for this.
Yeah.
But you picked out Jack Radel at Notre Dame as one of the ones who kind of really stood out. What was it about him?
Yeah, I think he's just a very polished strike thrower. I am always drawn to strike throwers. That might be a trend of the next two arms we're going to see moving forward. But he's never walked more batters than the 8.1% rate he had in 2024. He now has a 3-year track record as a full-time starter for Notre Dame. And he should wind up being the highest drafted Notre Dame pitcher since Aaron Heilman in 2001. But Radel, I think, what stands out to me, he just checks a lot of boxes as a high probability starter, and he took a step forward with his stuff this year. I'm not sure that he has a single plus pitch, but he has a whole lot of solid average pitches that you could look at and say are above average. He's now throwing a fastball that's sitting around 94 miles per hour, so that's closer to average velocity for a right-handed starter. I think the other...
Yeah, as someone who's been at BA for a long time,
you know, crazy.
When I started BA, that would have been like, he has a really plus fastball.
Right, right. So he gets up to 98, sitting 94, touching 98, is average now, crazy as that sounds for a starter. But he also has elite extension with that fastball. So while it might not be overwhelming in terms of velocity, I don't think the shape is that exceptional. I do think his ability to get down the mound could potentially help it play up. He also has a real solid assortment of secondaries. He's got a slider that is maybe his best secondary, this mid-80s gyro breaking ball that he throws with a lot of confidence to righties and lefties. He's got a cutter. He's got a changeup, a curveball that are all effective pitches. And when I see profiles like this, like Radel, you look at their overall college track record, you see them maintaining their strikes while finding more strikeout stuff. Like, previously, like coming into this year, I would say the swing and miss was a huge question with Radel. He'd never struck out more than 20% of the batters that he struck out in 2025. Well, he maintained the 6.2% walk rate that he had a year ago, which is a great strike rate, a great walk rate for a pitcher. And then he added 12 percentage points of strikeout rate. I feel a lot of safety with this pitching profile. I think that even if he's just quote unquote, just a back end starter, you'd be pretty happy with that outcome at a certain point in the draft. And I think he has been a consistent up air name for that reason. And just me personally, when I'm viewing him with a number of other pitchers who maybe have more obvious risk factors, I quite like the well-rounded nature of this profile is how I would phrase it.
Also, I mean, there are guys who you're like, okay, you're really projecting on how he fills out and all. Jack Radel is listed, again, listed weight, second largest pitcher, 6'5", 260, 250, I should say. Second largest pitcher in the, I would say the top like 40, 45 range for us.
Only was Hunter Deitch the other one, or Coleman Borthwick?
Coleman Borthwick, 6'6", 260.
Yeah.
You know, so Hunter Deitch, 6'6", 235. Another, you know, not a small dude himself, but but I would say that, like, it does stand out. Like, okay, just in perspective, Taylor Rabe is another guy we could be talking about here.
Yeah, I almost picked him.
is 6'5", listed 200. I think he's a little bigger than 200 right now, but he's not 250. So, like, you are talking about also a guy who kind of has that bring the innings to me and has shown that, has shown that at Notre Dame as well.
Yeah, he's thrown 53 innings in 2024, 70.1 innings in 2025. 87 innings in 2026. One thing that came out, and I'll just like tease one of the stories that's in our draft preview magazine. We really wanted to take a look at how teams were evaluating and developing high school pitchers compared to college pitchers. And one of the elements of that, one of the differences in those two profiles that I'm most intrigued by, because I think you could have two opposite takeaways, is like the idea of having a fresh arm versus a proven innings eating arm. I think there is something to the survivorship bias of college pitchers who have just been healthy and thrown for year after year with no injuries. I think there's, I have a lot of comfort with that. And I maybe lean closer to that than the, oh, let's take a fresh arm who hasn't thrown a lot of pitches at this stage, but I can go back and forth. And I think if you are a fan of like, hey, survivorship bias, you want your pitchers to have thrown a lot of innings, you want them to be equipped and ready to handle the volume of pro ball, I would imagine Jack Riddell would be near the top of your list in terms of guys who have proven they can do it.
I go back and forth, but I will say kind of along your lines, like, okay, a couple things. One, when you have guys who don't have innings because they've already been injured,
right,
that's one that we know is, again, it's not disqualifying, but it is a risk factor. So that's one. And two, we had a stretch. It's now 10, 15 years ago, but we had a stretch where there was this, like, I felt like 5-year, 6-year span from like 08 to like 13, 14, maybe even 15, where there was this trend of like, back when you were still, you know, a high school player yourself, but, but there was this trend of like, let's get this fresh armed college reliever and now we're going to start him. And the thought was, is that, hey, there's, you know, they don't have that many mileage on their arms and all that. And
yeah,
it didn't often work out. I'm not saying it never worked out, but it didn't often work out. And if you say why, it's like, well, to kind of go back to this whole, you know, the whole thing of like, why do shortstops go higher than like first baseman and outfielders? It's like most college relievers who are pitching as relievers were not pitching as relievers because when they walked in the door, it was like, you're the best guy we got here. There was always some kind of reason, like delivery, control, durability, something that meant we're going to put you in this role, not that role.
Right.
And to go back to what you're saying, like, I get it. Like, there are guys who absolutely are fresh arm because they haven't gotten to what they need to be. And some of those guys really do develop. But there is also something for the pitcher who's already shown it and basically shown that they can handle a workload, because that's the key part of this.
I agree. So,
that's on the college side, but there's a couple of high school arms as well. This, I would say, if I was going to say who's your number one guy who fit this from what, you know, from discussions we had on Slack and all earlier today, I would say that Blake Bryant, the right-hander from Douglas, Georgia, is another, is one who really did stand out. Is like, as you wrote him up, you're right. Like, ooh,
Yeah, and I feel like this also came across to various editors we had looking over these reports. Like, we had multiple people who reached out and like, hey, Blake Bryant, this kid sounds super interesting. And I wouldn't be surprised if we move him up on a future update, because really in this range, again, there's not a ton of separation. And Blake Bryant just checks a ton of boxes. I mean, this is the prototypical projection right-hander starter package. And he has, I think, everything you would want from a player of that profile. Great pitcher's frame, 6'5", 180 pounds. He's lean, athletic, moves well in the mound. It's one of the better arm actions in the class, according to a lot of the people that I'm talking to who are really getting in the weeds on deliveries and arm actions at a granular level. He repeats well. It's a balanced landing and finish. It's not a ton of effort. To start with, it's a great frame with a lot of the checkpoints you're looking for a pitcher who's going to be able to throw above average or better strikes moving forward. On top of that, he's got a very deep and polished pitch mix. The fastball is a low 90s heater with some arm side life. It's been up to 96. Everything I've heard is that he held that velocity really well throughout this season when he dominated his competition in Georgia. He's got multiple quality breaking balls with, I think, maybe a separator for many high school pitchers in general and in this class. He has two distinct breaking balls already. He's got a slider in the low 80s. He's got a mid to upper 70s curveball. Both of those have above average spin rates and above average potential. And then he rounds out the mix with a mid 80s changeup that has a chance to be at least average, I think. With more reps, he does not throw the changeup as much as the fastball and the two breaking balls, which is fairly common. But I think what we've seen from that pitch, it at least has me confident that it can become at least an average offering moving forward. So you put all of that together, and I think you're looking at a starter that has potential mid-rotation upside. And a player that I was reminded of when I was writing this report is actually Aaron Watson from the 2025 class. I feel like they have a lot of similarities just with the frame, the ease of the delivery, the polished pitch mix, the strike throwing. And Aaron Watson is doing a really nice job in the complex for the Reds. They just drafted him in the second round at 51 overall. We have Blake Bryant currently ranked 51 right now. So I just think in terms of total package, how they look, like my excitement about the profile after doing this sort of fine tuning and up report updating, man, I think he could go in the first round. I don't think there's a huge difference between him and like a Jensen Hirschkorn, who we have ranked a little bit in front of him. Maybe you'd say that like there is a little bit more dynamism with the slider with Jensen Hirschkorn. And what you saw at the area codes was super electric with him and like the athlete on the basketball court. But like Blake Bryant is a really standout athlete as well. So I really like this profile, and I guess it wouldn't be a Carlos Clauso draft podcast if I'm not raving about a high school right-handed pitcher, since I just geek out over that demographic.
You have to maintain the brand.
I do, yeah.
You know, you definitely have to maintain the brand. So when you are like, when you're looking at these high school arms, and again, like I said, there's a group of them here. I think one of the other tough parts of this is that you don't always see them. Like, it's kind of figuring out the, a lot of these guys, you don't see them at their best every time, obviously. You don't see college guys at their best every time. But I would say there's more variance with the high school arms.
Yeah.
So then you've got to figure out, to some extent, don't you, like, okay, how much weight do you put on the guy who's more consistent? Mm-hmm. How much weight do you put on the guy who, at his best, is he maybe a little bit better, but doesn't get to his best very often?
Right.
How much the guy who, like, you know, we have guys this year, I would say, who really kind of started slow and then ramped up. There's other guys who kind of hit the ground running.
I think for teams, that specific challenge you're talking about is very real for the high school pitchers, because it requires a lot more time. Like theoretically, every scout on your staff could go watch every college start, whether that's video, live, or after the fact. For high schoolers, you kind of have to be there at the field. Maybe you'll get snippets of a player's outing on video on Twitter or something else like that. But you really have to be at the field and watching them. And because of that, I do think there is an element of, hey, if you're a high school pitcher and you're consistent, you're probably going to have a more like consistent bit of feedback throughout a scouting department for people whose looks matter, versus maybe a more erratic high school pitcher who maybe the area scout goes in and sees him really good. You get your cross checker in the next outing, he's not finding the strike zone. And so you have maybe a wider range of opinions just based on your live looks. But I do think Blake Bryant was pretty locked in and consistent the entire spring, and that has to help him, I would imagine.
Okay. Speaking of a little bit more difficult to get looks, you also highlighted Sean Duncan, a Canadian pitcher. Now, let's point out, as we always do, like there, it's not something where you have to always go to Canada to see a good look at Canadian. You know, that's something that the Baseball Canada does a really good job of making
really, sure really good job,
exposure. Yep. But Sean Duncan is a British Columbian left-hander who's again been a name. Been someone I remember first seeing his name, you know, hearing from about. From Ben, I think a couple of years ago now. But what is it about Sean Duncan that kind of stood out to you as you wrote his report up?
Yeah, I was just checking back to see our kind of high school rankings history of Duncan, because he has been a prominent player in this class for a while now. Back in February of 2025, So more than a year ago now, we had him as a top 30 high school player in the class. I believe he's still in that range. We have him as a top 60 player overall. So essentially a similar sort of range. But Duncan, I think, is another pitcher who, after I came away writing this, watching more video, digging into our notes, I just really was impressed with the pitchability and the projection indicators that he has. He's a left-handed pitcher, in contrast with Bryant and Riddell, the two other arms we talked about on today's podcast. He's super young for the class, which is a common theme for basically every top Canadian prospect, it feels like. He turns 18 just 2 months before the draft. It's a frame that you can dream on, 6'3", 180 pounds, very lean. While there is a bit of length to the arm action, I think the delivery overall is quite impressive. He repeats it well. It's very loose. It's balanced. Another athletic, easy finish with Duncan, like Bryant. And while it's not a complete four-pitch mix, it is a really polished three-pitch mix. It's a fastball that sits in the low 90s. He's been up to 95. While that fastball, again, it feels crazy to say for a high school pitcher, especially a lefty touching 95, there are left-handed pitchers in this class who are throwing 6-7 miles per hour harder. Again, insane to say. But even if it's not absurd present velocity for Sean Duncan, I think between the physical projection that is quite obvious with his frame and the high spin nature of his fastball and just his ability to collect whiffs with it to the degree that he did last summer and really throughout his high school career, I feel like even if it's never a plus velocity pitch, I feel like it will be a consistent swing and miss fastball. It's also a fastball that he can establish to both sides of the plate. And maybe what stood out the most to me about Sean Duncan while digging deeper on him and finalizing this report was his ability to manipulate a breaking ball. He's got a upper 70s, low 80s slider that he can mix and match really well. He shows the ability to shorten the pitch up when he's throwing it for maybe strikes earlier in counts. He can expand it and use it as more of a chase offering. So whether it's a breaking ball that just has sort of this slurvy in between shape, or in the future he separates them out to make two distinct breaking balls, I think he's going to have the spin capacity and the feel to do that. And then he also sells a good changeup in the mid 80s that I think, again, is going to be a potential above average offering. So for Duncan, while maybe none of it is above average right now, I think projecting him into the future, which is what we're trying to do, you're looking at a left-handed pitcher who could have above average stuff across the board with above average strikes. And again, those are the kind of pitching packages that I really like. He's committed to Vanderbilt. We'll see like how tough of a sign he is, but again, I think like Bryant, this is a player who could go 30 spots in front of where we have him ranked, and it shouldn't be surprising on draft day.
Okay, before we wrap up, I should at least throw out the question, because we've talked about five guys who've, as you wrote them up, you're like, oh, is there anyone that comes to mind, not like, oh, this guy's not a draft prospect, but someone who came to mind that as you wrote him up, you're like, I hadn't really fully synthesized how many risk factors this player has.
The one who stands out to me that I think there is going to be a disparity in maybe how teams are viewing the player and what the performance shows if you've watched the season. The one that I struggle with the most is Aiden Robbins at Texas. I mean, his season was tremendous. His OPS was a top 10 mark among SEC hitters. His in-conference OPS, I believe, was a top 5 mark among SEC hitters, just looking at conference play. He looks the part, 6'2", 205 pounds, center field profile. He's got power. I do think Robbins has a very well-rounded tool set. But I think that there are just more hit risk questions that I have with his profile after diving in. He has a career 17% strikeout rate, which is not a surprising number. He hit well over 300, which is kind of what you want these guys to do. But when I was digging into the batted ball data and just the feedback from scouts, he misses a lot more than you'd expect given those numbers. And so I wonder, when he's challenged at the next level about contact against secondaries in particular, I wonder about pitch recognition with him moving forward. And because he's also a player that most of the scouts we've talked to think he's a better fit for a corner than center field, I do think there starts to be pressure on your offensive profile pretty significantly. And so if you're moving off center field, now you're a left fielder, let's say, and maybe the hit tool is not quite as explosive as your performance indicates, I would have some questions. So I would imagine he's going to be a very split camp player for a lot of reasons, but those are the ones that I kind of dug into and just raised my eyebrows a little bit about, because he scares me more than you might think, given what he showed us this year.
Right. It's something where, again, it's like his resume is his resume to some extent, but this is also part of his resume. It's a little bit harder to dig into, but like when you don't have as good of a contact rate, when you don't have as good as a zone contact rate as other players, that is part of your resume as well. And so again, it'll be interesting to kind of dive in. We've got still got another month of this. We'll be,
yeah, we do.
It's hard to believe because again, most of the players now, crazy enough, more than most years, when we roll around to Omaha, not many of our top 30, top 40 prospects in the game are still going to be playing, you know? So
yes, did any of those players you change your opinion on or get more excited about as we were going through them? Or if there was one maybe who stood out above the rest?
I would say Jack Radel, it does fit into kind of that perfect kind of back of the first round type arm, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're not, I think one thing that really intelligent Draftnik fans understandably get a little derailed on because of the way a lot of it, I would say, because of the way that this is portrayed on draft day and all, you know, and then like no one is compared on draft day on the broadcast and all to a, you know, this guy could be, you know, a fourth outfielder, right? That's not, because again, it's best case scenario, you know, ceilings, all that. And I do feel like a lot of times, again, you've talked about this on the podcast before. I think that doing the redrafts like you do is really useful. And basically what's really useful about it is realizing like, if he ends up being a number four, number five starter, and you knew that, if you could lock that in,
you'd be going middle or back of the first round. Yep.
Do it. Not that there's not going to be someone taken after who's going to be better than that, because there will be 100% promise, guaranteed almost. Yep. But there's also going to be a ton of guys. The thing that stands out from doing this year after year, and also like when you're doing, like when we get rolling on mid-season, like we're doing the updates for teams, right? You just mentioned like, oh, you know, the Reds second round pick and he's doing, you know, pretty well so far. One of the things that is remarkable about doing this though is the guys who you're like, oh, I remember that dude a year ago, let me check what he's doing, and then you're like, this is horrible, like players who were like considered legitimate top 75, top 100 prospects coming into the draft, and then they get to pro ball and they never have a minute of success. It's not like they hit double A and they got derailed. Right. I'm talking they hit A ball or they hit the rookie leagues and it was like, this is just too much for them. And it's sad because again, like, you know, we want prospects to succeed, but some of these players, it's like, you then have to go back and look and go, okay, where was the misevaluation?
Right.
Because it's useful for us too. Right. Like, and there are absolutely, sometimes it's okay, a guy was hurt for 5 years and then released. And it's like, okay, well, how do you evaluate that? Right. Like, okay, again, especially on our end, on the public sphere, you don't have access to all the medicals. But when someone gets drafted, you know, a pitcher gets drafted in the second round and has an 80 ERA for their career and gets released after 3 years, or a hitter has a 40% strikeout rate and never makes it above A ball and gets released and was a prominent pick, it's like, okay, there may have been concerns, but obviously it wasn't something where that was an expectation, because if it was, that player would have never been picked where they were. And so that's where I go back to, like, if Zion Rose, we're talking about him, like Trevor Condon, right? In a best case scenario, Trevor Condon is a really good regular who, like you said, let's say that gap power even develops a little bit further. And you're talking about an athletic outfielder who can hit for average with some power. And that's a really valuable, you know, that's like that could be a 3-4 WAR type player.
Right.
But if Trevor Condon ends up developing into more of a guy like, I know he just got sent down, but like he's just he's a TJ Friedel type, right? Mm-hmm. Who just got sent down by the Reds, but has had a couple of two war seasons in the big leagues as kind of a part-time everyday center fielder, a little bit of injury issues and all that. If he became that, that would be a pretty solid outcome. And again, that's where I think even as you get...
I think at some level, like if you are a major leaguer of any capacity, it's almost like always a draft win depending on the range. But like most of these guys will not be major leaguers. So if you can have a regular role, whether that's a bench role, right. If you just get a cup of coffee, yeah, but...
Yeah, and, right. If you are a guy, like one of the ways I always love to put it, because again, it all ties back to the Rule 5, but if you're a first round pick, mm-hmm. and when the Rule 5 protection year rolls around, your team looks at you and says, nah, we're going to leave you off the 40.
Right.
Okay, then that was a bad pick. Like I would just start right there. It's not a lot to spend to say that we, like our first round pick is going to take a 40 man roster spot. Mm-hmm. That is like, and if that player then eventually makes it up, okay, to take an example, and I'm not trying to pick on him, but if Jacob Berry ends up getting 200 plate appearances over 3 or 4 years, that doesn't change the fact that if you pick that high in the draft and you take a guy and then you leave him like, and you kind of, again, he's not really right. a prospect at this point. That's not what you want to do.
Right.
I would
Speaking of like figuring out what we missed on, that one will always be a shocker because I
actually think he is like looking now at data that we didn't have at that time.
Okay. Yeah. I'd love to hear this because we were so confident in the hit, the approach, the power, like and as soon as he got, it wasn't like, hey, he got to a certain level and then it backed up. It was like, as soon as he got into pro ball, it was never the hitter we expected him to be.
Jacob Berry is an example of a guy. Like I remember going back and looking at that and being like, you know, knowing what we know now, I just don't think he would have even like it was, there wasn't anything horrific about it. Mm-hmm. There just wasn't anything good. Right. Like,
okay.
Okay. I'm trying to help me here. Was his 2022 or 23?
Correct. His draft year, 2021 or 2022, excuse me.
22, right.
Six overall. Yep.
Again, like, he was like an 85 mile an hour average EV and a 104 90th for a slugging, don't have a position.
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like to just give an example of that in comparison, right? Like I'll bring up my guy, Drew Burris, but Drew Burris has questions about like how much impact will we have and all that. 92.1 mile an hour, you know, EV and 109. 90th. So mm-hmm. 5 miles an hour harder. And the question with Burris is he going to be a center fielder or is he going to be a corner? With Berry, it was like, he's a first baseman.
Since we're in the weeds here on mm-hmm. college hitter exit velocity data, this is one I'll just throw into the pod and throw at you because it is propaganda for my guy, Derek Curiel. Do you know who he hits the ball harder than?
Many.
This year's draft? Well, one in particular, and maybe I use this for Ben because this is Ben's guy. He hits the ball harder than AJ Gracia, who no one seems to have power concerns with. That one always is jarring to me. I think right. AJ Gracia's 90th percentile EV is just a little bit
I will
bit
say Curiel is very much like Zion Rose, just more extreme version of it, which is, okay, you hit the ball hard, but he doesn't have the ability to hit the ball hard.
I think there is a lot of... This is maybe, I don't know how much into the weeds you want to get, but I think it's fun to talk about. I think people far too often put hitters in holes based on how they're hitting as amateurs or young players when we know that learning to elevate and hit for power is one of the last things that come. And we see this so consistently with prospects who are taking massive jumps, whether it's the power that comes later or the elevation that comes later. I still... Like J.J. Weatherholt versus Travis Bezzano, that was the question. Like J.J. Weatherholt does not elevate and pull the ball in the air. Travis Bezzano does. That was a big question. Is that trainable? Can you project on that? You just say the guy who can do it now. I think people are far too, like they put hitters in boxes too frequently when I do think a lot of this stuff is approach oriented or maturity oriented. And so that's one of the reasons I'm bullish on Curiel, but I understand not everyone follows me on that hole.
This is an interesting thing, because it's like, okay, I would say that that meant that, like, you could, as you said, so much of this is eye of the beholder. On one hand, I can make the argument that that Bezzano has already demonstrated a skill that is a key big league skill, right?
Right.
Which is like, because Bezzano wasn't doing that. Like, when I say this, someone's going to hear me and say, oh, you're saying that everyone should basically start their swing around their shoe tops and end it somewhere basically above their head. That's not what I'm saying. But the ability, when you get a baseball to drive, to basically get your body into it and have a swing that hits that in the air to your pull side, is a skill that plays in the big leagues. We know this, right?
For sure. Yeah, I guess my point is that, like, it is not, I think sometimes because we have so much data now, we view traits as sticky and unchanging when they are. Like, even Travis Bezzano himself, like, he used to be a contact. I'm just hitting the ball. I'm always making contact. He learned what the pitches he could drive, why it was valuable, and how to lay off the stuff that he could just flare over.
And so what I would say is so I can look at that both ways, though. So on one hand, I can say that he's demonstrated a skill that's a valuable skill. On the other hand, I could also just as easily say he's much more maxed out.
Because I think that's the key. It's all a question of, like, what can you project on and what do you have to project on? What do you have currently now versus, like, what can you become? And, like, if you think you'd rather just have the sure thing, you don't need to project because he already has all these tools and traits that play, that could be one thing. Then the exact opposite end, you could be like, he's maxed out now as a player. He's already optimized. How are we going to make him better at the next level? I think those are such interesting and scouting questions.
This is where the evaluation really comes in, because like I can argue the flip side both ways, right? Like Justin Crawford is an example of a player who is never going to have as much impact at the big league level as he potentially could if he doesn't learn to hit the ball in the air more consistently. And he's still not particularly, you know, that's still not like, but he's a rookie. He's a big league rookie.
Right.
But so you could say, again, looking at it both ways, you could say, hey, if he, when he does, watch out, he's got another gear there.
Right.
Or you could say, he's been playing pro ball now for a number of years, and it hasn't.
He's not able
happened.
To. Right.
And take an example of a guy who was a top
61% ground ball rate right now.
Austin Martin.
Oh, no.
Austin Martin was a player who was drafted where he was with the idea that with everything he had as a hitter, he would be able to hit the ball in the air to his pull side more consistently. And once he did that, he'd be a more complete player. The Twins tried it for a number of years and it would not work. Maybe some other team, I don't know, but I will tell you this. Austin Martin didn't become a useful big leaguer until everything that was kind of put on him as we hope this is what he will be coming out of the draft. Mm-hmm. We hope he's going to step up the defensive spectrum. He's going to be a guy who's going to be a better second baseman than we think, center fielder than we think. Where he is right now, there's athleticism, room to develop. He's going to hit the ball in the air and show more power than he's ever showed at Vanderbilt. All these things. And it ended up, those were dead ends. Like, as long as they tried to do that, he wasn't a productive player. Mm-hmm. It was when they stopped trying to ask him to be a premium defensive player and more of kind of a versatile player who can play adequately at multiple positions. Yeah. It was when he said, and I think there was a David Lorila story with him from Fangraphs not long ago where he's basically said, I had to come to the point where I was like, no, this is the hitter I am. I'm going to stop trying to do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And then he became a useful hitter. But again, with less upside and ceiling, less impact than what they hoped for. So that's a perfect example of a guy who was a top pick who he couldn't do it. Because that's what I'm saying. Like, I can look at it both ways because on one hand, you absolutely, like, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. has had times where he is just this monster who hits for average and homers and all that. And there's other times where it's like his swing is geared to line drives and ground balls. And if you're Vladimir Guerrero sized and you're geared to line drives and ground balls, you're not as impactful.
Right.
And so like, there's, again, like I love about this is there's no guarantee on this. Well, that was quite a digression there we had. You know, we were wrapping up.
Hopefully it was interesting to more people than just us, but yeah, I think it's fun to talk through.
It was fun to talk to. So that is the Baseball America Draft Podcast for this week. As always, go over to baseballamerica.com. Carlos has a mock coming before too long, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
We'll have a staff draft coming after that. We'll probably get everyone onto the we'll probably try to do that the same way we did last one, where it was like, let's just roll and let's record it, and that will be all can enjoy the video version, the podcast version of that as well, coming up, you know, not too long after that. Mm-hmm. But for Carlos, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.